The headlines: Iran's president says the country trusts its own people instead of pinning its hopes on Vienna or New York, as Iranians mark the 43rd anniversary of their Islamic revolution. Russia slams as disrespectful and devoid of substance a joint response to its security demands by NATO and the European Union. Also, the World Health Organization says the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, as new variants could keep emerging. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story: Iranians have taken to the streets all across the country to mark the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. But the coronavirus pandemic has given a different look to this national celebration. Salman Kujiri reports on that.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars, and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus pandemic, waving flags of Iran and banners in support of their country.
I'm 15 years old. I'm here as a young adult to say that we don't care what the enemies are saying against the Islamic Revolution. We are here to show our support for our leader and our country.
I'm 43 years old as the Islamic Revolution. I'm here to voice my support for the Islamic establishment. When we see people are taking part in rallies across the country, it means that we have security and tranquility. Accordingly, we are here to honor the blood of our martyrs and celebrate our day of independence.
Speaking on the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said the country's foreign policy relies on balance and progress hinges on unity and convergence, and Iran does not pin hope on the West.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan, from the east to the west, north and south of the country. We have no hope in Vienna and New York.
In a statement at the end of the events, the demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country.
Analysts believe that after 43 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic Revolution, Iran has currently been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom-seeking and the oppressed nations of the world. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
Also in Iran, President Ebrahim Raisi has delivered a speech in the capital, Tehran, at a ceremony marking the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. He says his government has pinned no hopes on the West and relies solely on the Iranian people in achieving political and economic goals.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan, from the east to the west, north and south of the country. We have no hope in Vienna and New York.
President Raisi added the country's progress requires unity and said the future is very bright. He also said Iran has always managed to protect its political independence. The Iranian president noted that the Islamic Republic neither accepts any domination nor engages in any act of oppression. In addition, he added the Islamic Republic of Iran always seeks justice and plays a decisive role in the region. President Raisi hailed the Iranian people for their huge turnout in the rallies marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Indian-controlled Kashmir has also marked the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. On Friday, a conference was held in the central district of Budgam to commemorate the occasion. The event was addressed by a number of scholars and academics, highlighting the impact of the Islamic Revolution on Kashmiri people. Our correspondent in Kashmir, Sayed Ali Safi, has interviewed some of those attendees. Let's see what they had to say.
The influence of Iranian revolution in Kashmir has been very profound. Since the beginning, it was the revolution, the message of revolution was very well received by the people of Kashmir. And after almost now four decades have passed, and we still see that people associate themselves with the revolution, with the symbols of revolution, and with the message of revolution. So much so that in daily lives, I mean, people talk about it. They still get inspiration from it.
The justice and the liberty which was offered by the Islamic revolution to the Iranian population is something to which we look up to, and we see Iranian revolution as a ideal for us, so that we could also be a part of some kind of revolution which can bring a liberal and a society which is based on justice and equality.
It had a great and tremendous impact on the people of Kashmir. In Kashmir, irrespective of their sectarian affiliations, they had a deep impact of the Islamic revolution, especially of its leader, Imam Ruhullah Khomeini. And we saw how people would adorn his images in their homes, especially among the student class. It had a wider appeal.
Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA continued talks in the Austrian capital. This is the eighth round of negotiations to restore the agreement, which was thrown into chaos by the U.S. unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Homa Lezgi, our correspondent in Vienna, said that, she actually filled us in on the latest developments.
Today we had news that the three working groups working on three different issues in the Vienna talks have met, starting with the working group on nuclear measures or nuclear commitments by Iran. Iran's return to full compliance with the JCPOA meeting. This morning we're hearing for up to 3 hours. After that, we had the working group on sequencing or implementation. Of course, the working groups we know are made up of the experts representing both the Iranian team and the other teams from the 4+1 group, the remaining signatories of the JCPOA. And we just heard that the third working group on sanctions lifting is also meeting with the experts discussing the outstanding remaining issues. Earlier, the Russian ambassador to the talks, Mikhail Ulyanov, tweeted that he has had another, quote, very useful meeting with U.S. Representative Rob Malley. And in the words of Mr. Ulyanov, we are definitely moving ahead. He also said that the intensive negotiations that are currently taking place at the working group levels on all the major issues up for discussion here is taking place as the talks are apparently, in his words, in the final stage. So, again, last night there was a meeting between the 4+1 group and the U.S. Concerning the developments made. So what are the remaining outstanding issues? Up until this stage, we know the most important is guarantees. Iran insisting that it will not back down from that. It wants guarantees that can give it assurances the U.S. will not withdraw again. Can a future U.S. administration, can this administration assure that a future administration in the U.S. will not withdraw, will not reimpose sanctions? Is that going to be possible? How is Iran going to be assured on that? This is one of the questions. Also, there's verification, and that's the amount of time that's required, known as the preparation period, before implementation of a possible restored deal, whereby the U.S., by various means, will verify the effective removal of sanctions. And, of course, in order to verify Iran's compliance, there is the International Atomic Energy Agency. So verification on all sides.
We're following news out of Afghanistan, where an explosion has killed at least one civilian in the northern province of Badghis. Local officials say seven others have also been injured. The blast ripped through the gate of a mosque in the provincial capital, Ghalaunau, after dozens of worshippers gathered there for Friday prayers. According to officials, the cause of the explosion is unknown, but investigations are underway. Afghanistan has experienced a series of bomb blasts and attacks since the Taliban took power last August. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for some of those attacks. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the Russian Foreign Ministry dismisses NATO and the European Union's joint response to Moscow's letters regarding its security concerns. The ministry says the joint response lacks substance and is a sign of diplomatic impoliteness and disrespect for Russia's requests. Moscow sent individual letters to all member nations of the two blocs in early February. The letters outlined Moscow's concerns about NATO's eastward expansion and demanded clear responses. Instead, Moscow received a collective reply from the EU foreign policy chief. The content of the response has not been published yet. Tensions have been growing between Russia and the West over Ukraine. Washington has repeated its accusations, saying that Russia could invade Ukraine anytime now. Moscow denies the allegation, accusing NATO of provocative movements along Russia's borders. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg, Virginia, and also journalist and political commentator Fred Weir, who's joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Jones in Leesburg. Why is Russia not happy?
Well, obviously, the situation is extremely serious. The West looks as if it's going to play hardball with Russia to try and force them to back down from really all their demands. Demands are primarily oriented towards the issue of indivisible security, that is, that any kind of agreement must assure also the security of all the parties, including Russia. And nothing that the West has come with at this point has met that basic demand. The West, on the other hand, today, most recently, or last night, Secretary of State Blinken again called for the withdrawal of all Americans from Ukraine. There is a steady drumbeat in the Western media claiming that there will be an invasion of Ukraine by Russia, although Russia has continually denied that they will invade Ukraine. The issue, however, is very serious, because unless there is a diplomatic solution to this situation and the West continues the massive armaments into Ukraine, Russia may have to take such a decision, but I don't think they want to do this. They're seeking a diplomatic alternative, and unless there is some show from the West that they are willing to take into consideration Russia's own demands for secure borders and security from attack from Ukraine or any of the other powers on their borders, there is going to be no diplomatic solution. Foreign Minister Lavrov sent out his messages to all the Western leaders. He got a reply only from a joint EU NATO entity, and hopefully there will be other leaders that have received this letter that may take a different position. But unless there is some kind of sign from the West that there is a pathway to a diplomatic solution which does meet the fundamental goals or the fundamental demands of Russia, this could become a military conflict at any point.
Fred Weir, the Russian Foreign Ministry has dismissed the NATO and the EU's joint response, saying that it was a sign of diplomatic impoliteness and disrespect for Russia's requests. What is it that Moscow is looking for in these responses?
Basically, Russia wants a change to the security architecture of Europe since the end of the Cold War. Russia was prostrate during the 1990s. It objected, but couldn't do anything about the waves of NATO expansion that began in the late 90s. Russia absorbed this. I mean, it's quite remarkable when you pause to think about the geostrategic shift that has occurred. Like half of Europe, which was under, you know, part of the Soviet alliance, simply dissolved and joined NATO. Russia has accepted this begrudgingly, but NATO has rolled right up to its borders. It's basically marched 1,000 kilometers to the east since 1990. And for reasons best known to himself, Putin has stopped making demands, stopped talking about the problem, and laid down the gauntlet. The Russian troop and deployments on the border, they're so far, I think, mainly theatrical. They're meant to make the point that Russians are serious this time, and we want a full conversation. The thing they want is, to put it simply, an end, a legalized and confirmed end to NATO's expansion to the east. No Ukraine, no Georgia, Moldova in NATO. That's what they want, and they want this formalized somehow in a pact like the 1955 pact with Austria, maybe an arrangement like Finland during the Cold War. And it is possible, I think. I talked to Russian security experts who seem to think it is possible to create a belt of neutral countries between Russia and NATO. It could include Georgia, Ukraine, but it could also include Belarus, which is Moscow aligned, if the West were prepared to negotiate this, to like put cards on the table and accept this principle. They could negotiate good deals for all of those countries that would protect their sovereignty, their independence, their democratic systems, as Finland was during the Cold War. But for that, the West has to move off of this principle that NATO expansion is still open, the door is open, Ukraine will join, because for Moscow, those are fighting words.
All right, that's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Thanks to Mr. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joining us from Leesburg. Also thanks to journalist and political commentator Fred Weir speaking to us from the Russian capital, Moscow. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Moving on, the World Health Organization says the COVID-19 pandemic is not over and warns that new variants could keep emerging. The remarks come as countries across the globe are easing COVID restrictions following the Omicron variant surge, which was marked by less severe cases. Also, vaccination rates around the world have increased and there are fewer deaths related to the Omicron strain. That has caused optimism among many that the pandemic is nearing the end. The WHO, however, cautions that the pandemic is still ongoing and people need to remain vigilant and get vaccinated. The world witnessed a pattern of exponential spikes in infection rates after the new variant was first detected in November. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned. This worldly life is like a quagmire full of agony and distress. We human beings must ponder more upon our deeds. Death is like changing your dress. You are changing your dirty dress of this physical body to a new, otherworldly one. You are in the cage of your physical body, and death frees you from that cage. Death helps you to be freed from this physical body and join your spiritual body in the other world. Now, this spiritual body has root in your physical body. In other words, your spiritual body is taken from your physical body. It is like the seed of the almond, which is dry at the first look. However, upon squeezing it, oil will be extracted from it. This spiritual body of yours is eternal. All of your prosperity, humanity, and evolution depend on that spiritual body of yours, which is infinite up to the end of the world. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خاک گوهر خیز بحر وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Wall Street has bought more than $60 billion, and that's billion with a B, worth of housing. Giant companies now own hundreds of thousands of single homes. Many renters have to deal with corporations to rent a home, and many have to compete with rich companies to purchase a house they've been saving up to buy. Entire neighborhoods are being bought up by these companies to make profits out of rent, driving up prices of homes, and many families are being forced to evict. Now, companies are taking advantage of the COVID-19 crisis to buy foreclosed homes, and now the dream for an American to own a house has turned into a nightmare.
Corporate landlords.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll speak about corporate landlords in America, how large corporations have taken advantage of economic crises and bought up a massive number of homes. What are the problems with renting from a corporation? How has it become extremely difficult to buy a home while you need to compete with Wall Street? And what has the government done to help the ordinary citizen in this crisis? As usual, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Rafiki Morris, who is an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and Alex Powers, who's an opinion journalist. Please stay with us.
Giant companies now own hundreds of thousands of single-family homes in the United States, pushing tenants for revenue, hiking up rent, and forcing Americans not to dream about owning a house anymore. Wall Street has pumped in some $60 billion to buy thousands of properties meant for middle-class buyers.
Now, in some instances, institutional buyers have even bought up entire neighborhoods, and all of this is just pushing prices higher. So what are corporate landlords?
So corporate landlords are when the banks and private investment funds, for example, like BlackRock, they'll go ahead and they'll get cheap money from the Fed, and then they acquire all of the properties they can get their hands on, residential, corporate, anything they can get at either a low-cost value or something that has potential long-term value that they can acquire cheaply because the tenants have an issue with paying it, the landowner needs to sell, or... But it's when there's a roll-up of properties taken up by corporate entities so that they control the vast share of properties while the average citizen is now going to be forced to rent from them.
As corporations started buying a massive number of homes, renting them out, and effectively becoming landlords, tenants started being evicted on short notice. Now, these companies do not do much on maintenance front, and reaching management is extremely difficult. More importantly, they hold back on their responsibilities as much as they can. Only thing that matters to corporate landlords is rental yields, and as long as the money comes in, they buy more homes.
Most people's main wealth in life is their home. That's where they've invested most of their funds, and that's where they collect equity. That is the wealth that they possess. And so when the corporations take over that process, and it's always a corporate process because the banks are also corporate landlords, they're actually extracting the wealth from the community, and they're doing it without the well-being of the community at mind. So a lot of times you have the housing stocks are not well made, not well maintained, not livable. And generally in the areas where the poorest people live is where you pay the highest rents for the least amount of space. So actually it's a way of draining the money out of the pockets of the people who really have the least amount of money to spend.
After the COVID-19 pandemic hit the United States, these companies took advantage of the crisis and started buying more homes. The U.S. government is pumping new cash into the economy that's eventually making its way into these institutions. This is why they have the financial power to keep buying new homes. These actions are vastly distorting the U.S. housing market. People looking to buy new homes have to compete with companies like Invitation Homes, which is the largest home leasing company in the country.
So the problem with corporate landlords is that they can control the prices. They can be able to survive when the free market normally would either make someone sell or attract buyers to buy. So what they're doing now is they control the market, so they can control the prices on rent, they can control the prices on properties, they can afford to sit and wait for, 50 years if they really want to. They have the money. Remember, they get the money for nothing. I mean, not nothing, but one tenth of a value. These are fractional reserve banking. For every $1 that's deposited, the central bank issues 10. So, they have plenty of money that they can use to acquire these properties, and that directly affects the free market. And that's the real problem with this.
The roots of these corporations going into the single home market goes back to 2008, when real estate prices dropped sharply and forced homeowners to default on their loans. The people that lent money were left holding millions of properties they couldn't put to good use. And the U.S. government wanted to fix this crisis. They wanted somebody to come in and buy these homes in a bid to shore up prices.
After the housing crisis of 2008, hundreds of thousands of families were losing their homes. It seemed that prices would keep dropping with no end in sight. As the years passed, the U.S. government thought that there needed to be some intervention. In their view, there would be terrible consequences for the economy as a whole if nothing was done. The government needed more buyers, but who? Since mortgages were now hard to obtain for the average Joe, and regular Americans were scared away because of the crisis, the government thought that Wall Street would be the perfect candidate for the job.
In 2012, the U.S. government launched a program which allowed institutional investors to buy foreclosed homes by the hundreds from a government agency known as Fannie Mae. They also allowed these investors to rent out these places. Now, according to The Atlantic, between 2011 and 2017, large private equity groups, hedge funds, and other big investors spent around $36 billion to buy up more than 200,000 homes across America. So what is Wall Street's objective of going on a home buying spree?
The only wealth in the cities is the land, right? The land itself. And by buying up this land, you gain a monopoly over the primary resource that the people have. The purposes and the uses that they put the land are those that are going to create the most wealth. So those rental properties, those long-term leases, those condominiums, I mean, they even figured out a way to make money off of government-subsidized housing. And now Wall Street comes in. Well, once Wall Street comes in, you know, the human factor is eliminated, because the only purpose for Wall Street is to increase the size of their capital, of their stakeholders, of their investors. So, but it's really the same thing. It's just a different way to do what they've been doing all along.
The private equity-backed Invitation Homes raised rent prices by almost 11% in the third quarter of 2021. The problem with rent hikes has become so huge that Americans are forming tenant unions to go against corporate landlords. The director of housing campaigns estimated that hundreds of new tenant unions have been formed during the pandemic. Can the development of tenant unions help American tenants with the rising costs of rent and other costs that corporate landlords impose?
The tenant unions may work, but if they don't own the property, they really don't have much say. I mean, they can complain and try to take it to court, but if they don't own a property, they don't own it. So they can have tenant units, they can complain about quality, and they can work together on certain small issues. But when it comes to eviction or something, they don't really have any influence. And frankly, in the end, they really don't have much power, because the owner of the building has ultimate control over it.
When houses are sold to cash-carrying investors for conversion into rentals, prospective homeowners and mom-and-pop landlords are crowded out of the market, and communities suffer, particularly communities of color. Poor communities with bundles of foreclosed homes and cheap property are prospective investment opportunities for Wall Street. And when corporations become landlords, they are far likelier to evict a tenant than a private owner. So why is it easier for companies to evict a tenant?
Well, I mean, the tenants are not organized. The private owners, they're protected by the banking system. But the tenants, they're not organized. They don't have any kind of power. They only recourse is to the courts, and most of them cannot afford to go into court with a lawyer to defend their rights as tenants. So this makes them vulnerable. These are vulnerable parts of the population, and this is why the corporations tend towards building rental units. You have short-term leases. The tenants basically have no rights unless they're organized. They can be abused, particularly if it's the elderly or disabled people who also have other needs that they have to reach. It's the way the system is set up.
The properties in poor communities can be bought in bundles, and the whole neighborhood might be transformed with the demolition or renovation of properties and rising rent. the price of rent and mortgage of the whole neighborhood would then increase, forcing the poor residents to look for homes in neighborhoods farther away and in some cases becoming evicted and homeless.
Prices have been driven up by institutional money pouring into the housing market to snatch up homes as investment properties, including the homes of those recently evicted during the pandemic. To make matters worse, some large investment firms are lobbying to end eviction protections so that they can acquire even more houses, adding to the housing demand and homelessness problems at the same time. With single-family homes out of reach for the average working American, the media has begun trying to frame perpetual renting as a good thing, something that benefits young people. The problem there is that even renting is becoming prohibitively expensive. There are now officially zero counties in the entire country where a worker earning the federal minimum wage can afford a one-bedroom apartment. Even for those making significantly more than minimum wage, things are looking pretty grim. There's a common joke that goes something like, "The bank said I couldn't afford an $1,800 a month mortgage, so now I pay $3,000 a month in rent."
Federal government policies have spurred the trends of corporate home ownership and rental businesses. For example, most of these large institutionalized companies are receiving a huge tax break, being exempt from federal taxes due to their status as real estate investment trusts. So what could be done and what measures could be taken to stop these companies?
Yeah, so the average person can't compete because they don't have, one, access to cheap money at very low interest rates, and two, they're not able to buy on a free market prices. So without having that control over the market, and people are basically forced into a monopoly because they don't have either access to the property and or they're renting and they're paying so much money that they can't save up enough money to buy a property. So there's so many different factors, but in the end, it's very dangerous for our society to allow this to happen because the home ownership is very, very important in any economy. And when you have people that are renters, and they're renting from corporations, not even private individuals.
To exert more power, single-family rental companies are marshalling their collective political clout. In 2014, Starwood Waypoint launched the National Rental Home Council, NRHC, a nonprofit trade association that seeks to combat negative press coverage and communicate the industry's value proposition, promote and defend the industry to stakeholders, policymakers, and regulators, and reframe the existing stigma around renters. This has made Wall Street landlords a growing political lobbying force.
The federal and the state governments are not on the side of the tenants. I think they're on the side of the corporations. I mean, the federal and the state operate according to laws. The laws are created by legislators, and the legislators create the laws depending on the lobbying that they receive. So these corporations are lobbying these legislators. They're pushing legislation that favors them. And it's mainly to maintain the status quo, to safeguard their rents, to safeguard their private property. Most of the laws in the United States are based on the protection of private property. And so the tenants are really up against the state and the corporations. I mean, if you think about it, every law that's passed by a state or the national government, it ends up being a contract that is fulfilled by some corporation. So anytime they want to build something, somebody gets a contract. Anytime they want to tear something down, somebody gets a contract.
In every crisis in America, there seems to be a huge opportunity for large corporations and the rich to earn more money and at the same time make the poor and middle class sink even more into poverty and hardship. Housing crisis and now COVID-19 handed this opportunity to the companies with the help of the U.S. government. So while poor minorities, especially African-American and Latino communities are hit harder by the pandemic. These miseries by large corporations also rained upon them, making it harder to cope in an unequal and unjust system.
Housing is a human right. However, under the American capitalist system, housing is a commodity. Today on Power to the People, we will examine the intentional housing crisis that capitalism itself has created. As a reminder, capitalism is when a few people own and control all the means of production in society. This means that in actuality, there's only a few capitalists, and everyone else who doesn't own the means of production, they are subjected to the rule of the capitalist class. Capitalism requires complete corporate domination over the economy, and the housing and the real estate market is no different. American corporations like Blackstone, which is the largest corporate landlord in the world and is worth $649 billion, is one example of complete capitalist world domination over the housing market. Blackstone owns properties all over the world, and it's been cited by the United Nations for the mass purchasing of single-family homes after the devastating financial crisis in 2007 and 2008. Blackstone is responsible for raising rent at astronomical rates, practicing aggressive eviction practices, as well as giving out racist subprime loans, which have all contributed to the capitalist-created global housing crisis. And all of this was done to target communities of color. Blackstone is also responsible for forgiving billions to the Zionist regime. Blackstone is a perfect example of how Wall Street has bought up real estate, effectively making Wall Street the biggest landlord in the world. All of this can be traced back to the foundation of this country. All the wealth built for corporations was born out of the enslavement of Africans, as well as the genocide of indigenous people, as Wall Street itself was originally the place where they sold enslaved Africans. America has always had racist housing policies, whether it was Jim Crow segregation or the racist redlining of cities. And the major event that led to Wall Street becoming the biggest landlord is the 2008 housing crisis. The crisis was self-created by Wall Street, where they purposely crashed the market. Consequently, 9 million people lost their jobs and at least 10 million people lost their homes. As the market crashed, Wall Street went in and they bought up the whole market. They bought up hella homes. An Atlantic article, it reported that between 2011 and 2017, large private equity groups and hedge funds and other big investors spent $36 billion on 200,000 houses. If we look at one zip code in Atlanta, for an example, corporations bought up 90% of 7,500 homes that was sold in 1 year. Literally the same people responsible for causing the housing crisis are the ones that made the most profit. This corporate monopoly over housing is just yet another part of this evil capitalist system. While Wall Street made billions of dollars, the people suffered. It made homelessness worse, and it was reported that over 1.5 million people used emergency shelter or a transitional housing program from October 1st, 2008 to September 30th, 2009. Corporations, they have been ever evolving to have market domination. Recently, in a new model called iBuying, tech companies like Zillow, they've been using algorithms to protect the houses that they can buy quickly and flip quickly. In just a few months, Zillow spent over $30 million buying a property. This has allowed companies to essentially buy control of certain markets. Then they're able to set the price of the market, and this allows for bigger investment funds to either buy these companies out or to purchase properties directly from these iBuy companies. As a result, over 500,000 people in America sleep in the streets every single night while these corporations use algorithms to buy up houses. And it's not like there's actually a housing shortage as some of these corporations tend to imply. Rather, there's an influx of housing that's available. The White House has reported that there's almost 17 million potential homes that are empty. 17 million. Literally, the president can choose to sign an executive order and nationalize vacant property and house every single person living on the street, and there would still be over 16 million vacant homes. But this is what capitalism does. It allows for corporations to buy up all the real estate and allows for corporations to then evict the people and put them in the streets. This then allows these same corporations to say, we must build more houses to solve this so-called housing crisis, even though there's millions upon millions upon millions of houses available. And corporations, they do this and they make billions of dollars. And this is the result of when profit is the main course of human interaction, right? And American corporatism, all this affects the whole world, not just America. The United Nations reported that, quote, global real estate represents nearly 60% of the value of all global assets, or 217 trillion US dollars, with residential real estate comprising of 163 trillion US dollars, or 75%. This represents more than twice the world's GDP. The commodification of housing is an inherent part of this parasitic system called capitalism. It allows for corporations to be the rulers of the land, and consequently, the people are subjected to that rule. It is a system that would rather people starve in the street than to hand out a free meal. It's a system that allows someone to sleep outside during a snowstorm rather than giving that said person one of 17 million unused homes. This is power to the people.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Thank you, and bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.